You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm George Ingram, and I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings. I am very pleased to be hosting this session on public-private partnerships with Project Concern International. Brookings is an independent policy research institution, and PCI is an international global NGO that works in the space of development and relief in the United States and around the world. Particularly relevant to today's conversation, PCI has been involved in public-private partnerships and is co-hosting this session today because both they and we want to learn more about what this entity is that's called a public-private partnership. I want particularly to thank PCI Press and CEO George Guimaraes for co-hosting the session with us today. The term public-private partnership is ubiquitous in the development parlance. But as is frequently the case, all too often we use terms and don't really know what we're talking about. I have found that to be my own situation, and therefore a year or so ago I began doing some research on public-private partnerships to try to understand them better. I'm still involved in trying to work out that understanding. And I'm expecting that our speaker and our panelists today will help us solve this riddle, or at least shed some light on what are public-private partnerships, what makes for a well-structured, successful one, what are the incentives, the interest of the various parties for participating in public-private partnerships, where along the continuum from philanthropy to shared value does a particular PPP sit, and does it make a difference from the perspective of achieving sustainable impact? And finally, how do you measure the results and the success of a PPP? Roger Ford, who's managing director of Accenture Development Partners, will launch our dialogue. In directing this part of Accenture, Roger manages what is the development practice in the organization that provides consulting services and technology to the international development sector on a not-for-profit basis and has been involved in a number of public-private partnerships. Prior to this role, Roger was in the energy section of Accenture, particularly in the petroleum area, and also worked on convenience retail marketing. So Roger brings to this conversation a lot of experience in business, in development, and how you structure and manage public-private partnerships. After Roger's keynote, a panel will join us on the stage for a conversation. Roger?
Hello, everyone, and thank you, George, for such a great introduction. What I wanted to do, first of all, is just tell you a little bit about what George said, and that is really the uniqueness of Accenture Development Partnerships in one of the largest organizations of the Fortune 100, and that is Accenture. We are Accenture itself, as you probably know, is over a 230,000 person international global consultancy that focuses on literally every industry group on Earth. And one of those interesting factors of Accenture is how can you apply business consulting skills and technology skills to the international development sector? And that was really one of the key principles that was the foundation of Accenture Development Partnerships. And we've been around for 13 years. And the uniqueness of this model is what George mentioned, and that is we're a not-for-profit consultancy. And being a not-for-profit consultancy means you can do a lot. First of all, you can be accessible to many organizations that normally wouldn't be able to afford commercial consulting, management consulting rates that are quite high in the context of international development. But second of all, you can be around for the long term, and you can take risk, and you can also try out new innovations and apply different models to PPPs and development. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is really based on those factors. So I've been serving as the COO and the Director of Growth and Strategy for the organization for about 8 years. You know, before this, I had no knowledge whatsoever of international development. So I'm truly coming at this from someone who had a strong, relatively strong business background, showing up and saying, you know, how can you apply business to development? And when I did that to my boss 8 years ago, I said, you know, I'm seeing a lot of NGOs out here, donors, private foundations, where's the corporates? And he was like, you know, corporates and NGOs and development sectors, they just don't get along. They're at the opposite ends of the spectrum. So it's kind of interesting that we've come so far in those past 8 years. And what I've seen with these PPPs forming, it kind of gets me very excited as, you know, what the next eight years are going to offer when it comes to the sustainability and the way development will function. But we also have one thing I should mention is we have a very unique position being, you know, commercial consultants, as well as serving on the international development side of the house. And that is, we already serve, you know, 2/3 of the Fortune 500 and about 90% of the Fortune 100. So that essentially gives me a hall pass in a way to approach a large oil company or a products company or healthcare, you name it, and say, would you like to participate in this very unique concept? We're trying to impact education or health or even access to energy. And, you know, at least I can get in the door to the right stakeholder, the right individual. So that's a little bit about me and a little bit about what I think my role is unique. So when I talk about PPPs, I'm really talking about them from the angle of a practitioner and an intermediary as a consultant. So you can imagine when I'm approaching an organization, I'm saying, what can we do? How can we connect? How can we help you achieve your issue and your outcome? But at the same time, ultimately, I'm also saying, how can I be a convener, an intermediary between these groups? And the nice thing which has happened recently is, you know, partnerships are really the means to an end. They're not one that I say, let's create a big partnership and do some good stuff together. It's kind of like, how can I apply market forces to solve your problem? So it's a different way of thinking about partnerships. Many NGOs would just like to jump out there and say, you know, I'd love to be on this bandwagon of these PPPs. I hear it. I have to have corporate engagement. But in fact, they should be asking about what's the best solution for sustainability? What's the best solution of creating jobs? What's the best solution for, you know, sustainable healthcare or skill building? And a lot of that answer these days is through a partnership. It's not through, let's go to USAID and ask for $1 million and, you know, put it into schools in Tanzania. That used to be the issue, it's not anymore. So when I'm speaking this language these days, or our team, we're talking about the partnership actually being the vehicle, being the model that solves the problem versus the other way around. So essentially, you know, when we think about a PPP, George touched on it, you know, we're thinking about both the private sector, the public sector, civil society, and typically government as an end beneficiary, but you can also think of government as also essentially a bilateral funder in many cases, a multilateral funder. So you might think of government in different dimensions depending on what role they're playing. So there might be more than one government involved here, of course. And I think when you're dealing with the private sector, you know, you have to think about what is driving them to a partnership. And we say this to NGOs, we say, you know, think about this in a private sector lens. It's not really rocket science per se to understand that most of the companies that are doing partnerships at scale are publicly traded and they have shareholder expectations. Typically, those shareholder expectations result in a higher share price or a profit. And if they do their job right, you know, this term shared value means they can make profit but also achieve social impact at the same time. But if they focus on getting the profit right first, social impact is a natural outcome by having to diversify supply chains, creating an inclusive workforce, entering new markets, you know, creating great relations with other organizations. These are all natural connections that are going to happen as part of the model. So obviously, when we think about those other players, so that's the private sector. When we think about the public sector, you know, the governments, and others, if you're talking about USAID or DFID or some of the other bilateral agencies or even the UN as a multilateral, you know, these guys are going to be driven by leverage. And they see the private sector providing leverage that they themselves, they don't want to be the guy holding the bag anymore. You know, funding's tight. It's going to be increasingly tighter moving forward, and therefore by de-risking themselves from holding the bag, essentially. And there's been a lot of projects over the years, as we all know, across the development sector that have ended with, okay, it's done, the money's dried up, where do we go next? And I think it's sometimes a little painful to kind of keep dragging on a donor-funded program with no sustainable way of success being defined. So the whole idea with these guys is, let's get some skin in the game from others. They're also a little skeptical sometimes. Do we really want to be seen as helping the private sector? But if you think about it, it is the best solution for sustainability, because ultimately, if the private sector, if there's no market, these things are not going to succeed on their own. And then, of course, we have the development sector and civil society, you know, these NGOs and others. I mean, these are really the boots on the ground. These are the warriors that are out there that know how to get things done in those countries. And I can tell you, I've had many a private sector company come to me and say, where do I get started in Tanzania or Kenya or Southeast Asia, wherever it is? Who would I talk to? Who's good? Who may not have the best track record? It's essentially looking at using the right relations with the right NGOs and other partners. And the NGOs have the benefit of essentially getting access to essentially resources, which you would immediately think it's money, because that's what, you know, NGOs typically, you know, they need to keep their funding streams going. But increasingly, it's expertise and it's innovation. And they're almost becoming more valuable themselves than just, you know, the dollars they might get through a typical, you know, corporate to NGO relationship. So that's pretty significant to see that change happening. So essentially, you know, international development itself is organically changing. It's not something, you know, I was talking those 8 years, it's not something that anybody deliberately did. It's just the world changed around us. I used to go into markets like Kenya and Tanzania, and the only thing out there was Accenture Development Partnerships. I'm talking with my own company. Nowadays, I go in there and I see our corporate and commercial partners working on true commercial engagements in those same markets. And that's what's going to continue to happen. So essentially, I thought coming into this, you know, when the PPP started arising, that this was a novel trend. I don't think so anymore. I think this truly is something that's going to be critical to long-term growth and sustainability in these markets. And it's rapidly accelerating day by day. So essentially, let's think about issues versus outcomes. And I like to use one example for this, and it's one I've been heavily involved with for the past 2 to 3 years, and that is the energy access issue. I think we're all familiar with the fact that, you know, there's approximately 1.3 to 1.5 billion people that don't have access to electricity or lighting. And there's many countries, take Uganda and others, that may be 85% of the population. And that's the issue. I mean, essentially, you know, how do you solve that problem? So what we look at is, you know, essentially, what can be the outcome of resolving that problem? And essentially, the outcome is, how do you create market-based solutions? Because this isn't, again, a technical problem. If it's just a technical problem, we would go in there and run a grid, and it would be a very stable, and everyone would have electricity, and we'd be done. But this is a market-based problem, and that's the challenge. Is this came to me, Accenture got heavily involved with the UN, and we basically said, how can we bring market-based solutions to address this issue with true outcomes? And I've been spending a big piece of my time approaching the companies that have said, I stand up, I will help you achieve this goal. And now the rubber meets the road. You know, well, what are you willing to do? And it's going to be a challenge. And I can tell you that the Secretary General would like to see by 2030 this problem being addressed. But it's going to be having to be addressed by true PPPs that take market-based approaches, where we build models and we build market-based approaches that are going to be sustainable and scalable. And I think that's one of the most important things, is that these can't be silos anymore. For a while, PPPs have been, George mentioned, philanthropic in nature, very siloed little CSR initiatives. But when you take a problem of 1.5 billion people and try to solve them with simple little silos and CSR initiatives, I mean, I'll doubt, be, you know, be grateful if we get a million people, you know, on sustainable power, let alone $1.5 billion. So we're basically looking for winning formulas and solutions. We actually put our own money behind this, and we established three microgrids in Uganda. You know, just basically wired up villages. And essentially what we're doing is we're testing models that we can then take forward to commercial, you know, private sector organizations, as well as NGOs and others, to essentially replicate sustainable models for off-grid electrification. So we have you know, some small entrepreneurs that have gotten onto these microgrids. We have the clinic, we have the school online as anchor tenants, and then we're now actually spawning off true innovative social enterprises. There's a barber shop, there's someone doing sewing, and we hope to replicate that model across Uganda and across South Africa later this year and take it from there. And then if we can get larger utilities involved and, you know, others involved, this is a type of PPP that will truly go to scale. So essentially, what, you know, what are some of the key tenets of good PPP, some of the good takeaways? You know, they have to be, first of all, organizationally agnostic. You know, you can't be saying, I really want to be working with Coca-Cola. Wouldn't it be great if we got Chevron involved? I mean, they may be a great player and they may be a great plan for attacking the problem. But basically, you know, are they the best partner? Do they have the capability, the innovation, the resources? Basically, do they have the time to dedicate to the partnership? You know, essentially, the impact we can achieve, irregardless of who is the, you know, multinational involved or even the NGO for that matter, you know, the impact that we ultimately achieve will trump any type of brand and any type of sector. So it doesn't matter if it started out as an oil company. Maybe you have an oil company like Chevron impacting more healthcare in Nigeria than, you know, a healthcare company could. And that's why I say it has to trump what we would think the traditional industries might look like. And then we need to be market driven, right? We need to harness the power of the markets, the funding, the leverage. And most importantly, you're probably hearing a lot about innovative finance. And, you know, this is really going to change the game, I think. This is where we're going to get investors. You call them impact investors. You might just call them, you know, any person in this room, someone who wants to make, you know, a sustainable profit and also help the world. But investing in these markets, we need to figure out how we're going to do that at scale, because there's not enough projects that and programs out there that have the compliance structures, that have the M&E, the monitoring and evaluation frameworks, to really allow investment. But once this investment starts flowing, it's going to be huge, and it's going to trump anything that the bilateral or multilateral donors are doing to date. And it's starting as we speak. And then finally, these things need to be sustainable and scalable. They shouldn't be dependent on any one condition being achieved, any one partner. I've seen partners come and go, you know, and any funding source or major assumption, because these are the things that really can kill a partnership early on. And finally, you know, you should think about what happens if the partnership isn't successful and how you either transition this thing to the, you know, local population, or you unwind it, or what happens. And, you know, I've seen, I'll say, boneyards of partnerships out there that, you know, didn't have a plan for if they weren't successful or weren't sustainable. You know, microgrids where the main generator is missing. You know, computers in the side of a school that have no monitors anymore. I mean, so if it's not done right, if it's not thought through, what happens? And you need to have maintenance of the partnership as well. So there's a lot of things I could say about, you know, what's attracting the private sector. I mean, when we meet with our clients, why are they doing this? I've been bounced around every possible part of the private sector you can imagine. So when I'm approaching a large multinational corporate headquarters, I might bounce around to the CSR guy. Oh, let us introduce you to our foundation. Nope, it's our real estate group. I think that's our frontier markets investing group. And I think it might be our core business. We have a little bit of residual funding left. And you can imagine it's pretty interesting to see this in action when you're actually meeting at the headquarters of a multinational. But I can tell you it happens all the time. And a lot of times, that's probably the most important thing to understand is who is funding this. Is this core business or is this CSR? And we're going to talk a little bit about that on the panel in a few minutes. But if you understand that, you'll kind of know what's behind the company and what's going to drive the success of the partnership. Is there an internal rate of return, an IRR in place, or is this just something that the, you know, foundation has some money they want to put at it this year? Also, of course, brand and reputation is critical to the private sector. And you can't forget that. So the private sector does not want to be associated with partners ships that are PPPs that fail. Or that might, you know, if there is some issues out there with corruption or with things that aren't as, you know, things that we don't want to talk about, you know, it's not like you want your brand, you know, rubbed through, you know, the dirt on that stuff. What's worse than having to take a big write-off of a few million bucks is having your brand written up in the Wall Street Journal negatively. And, you know, how this partnership went wrong. And, you know, that's the worst thing that can happen. That can be, you know, millions off the stock price. A license to operate is why many organizations are interested in partnering corporates. This is because they need to show the government where they're maybe harnessing resources or, you know, working to get certain business licenses or certain tax incentives. Basically, if they do something good, if they're shown as inclusive in the market, the government will give them the license that they're seeking or the regulatory and policy, concessions. There's also the long-term frontier growth. And I truly believe outside of a few markets in Africa that we will see, you know, everyone's lifetime in this room will see the frontier markets continue to expand much more quickly than the traditional emerging markets or, of course, the developed markets. So really exciting. I see it every day, even with our own company. Development sector and NGOs, this is going to allow them to improve their livelihoods. A good functioning partnership allows employment. Employment allows people to get better health care, access to education, and access to basic services. I don't want people to forget that access to basic services by having corporates enter a market is extremely valuable to the local population. So corporate supply chains that, you know, provide access to fortified food or other, you know, medicines and other medical supplies that may not be available. These are all very important. The only way it's going to happen is if a corporate comes in there and establishes itself, in many cases, products companies that can then distribute goods and services through their supply chains. Human capital development is also extremely important. I mean, this goes into the women's issues and every other part of this is training and creating market relevant skills that can be used to develop a country's, you know, economy, to develop a country's buying power. I mean, this is all around human capital development. If people don't have jobs, they don't have the skills, you'll never be competitive. And finally, the innovation. We're seeing just an amazing amount of inverse innovation now coming out of the developing world. And, you know, products and ideas like M-Pesa, which is the mobile money transfer system that was developed by Vodafone with DFID and the government of Kenya. I mean, the capabilities of transferring money between cellular phones and the concepts that go around with these types of services are truly innovative, and they will be able to be leveraged back to the developed world. Whether there's more regulation or other constraints, that's yet to be seen, but the concepts that are propagating themselves and coming up in the developing world are truly innovative. And we already mentioned the donors, so I'm not going to drain that again, but, you know, they're looking for leverage. They're looking for private sector skin in the game. And if all is done well, probably the hardest stakeholder here sometimes, I'd like to say, is the end beneficiary government. They are the beneficiary of growth and societal impact on their populations, but they can also sometimes be the hardest to get a partnership off the ground due to regulatory and policy constraints. And this is one we spent a lot of time. You might think, oh, you know, this is a great partnership. It's going to be between this large products company, this energy company, this donor. I mean, who wouldn't want this partnership in their country? Believe it or not, working with a very large multinational, multi-stakeholder partnership right now, where we're having to sell the governments to take our partnership. We're not asking for any money. We're just selling them on the concept of this partnership, which is going to be huge for their economies, which is going to be huge for job growth. But they have other options, they say. And if they don't see the benefits, if it's not clear, if it looks too private sector focused, you know, they say they'll move on. So you can't underestimate that you actually have to do some selling to the governments themselves, which is kind of interesting because you don't usually think about it that way. You know, a couple lessons learned. I'll move on here to, you know, what would be my takeaways from this whole thing? I mean, one is vision. You know, each of our partners need to share a common vision and provide complementary skills. I mean, if you're stepping on one another, if partners aren't seeing the shared impact, the shared value they can achieve together, the partnership probably won't succeed. I also see the fact that some partners tend to do more heavy lifting than other partners. You know, some partners are a partner in name only. And I don't really think it's often fair, and I don't really think it's often successful when this happens, but it happens more often than not, where, you know, a partner might write a check or say they're going to be a partner, but just kind of ride the teaming agreement and ride the partnership. And I think it's extremely important that everyone take an active and, you know, key role in this partnership. And I think it's done by the role that I play and many others. And that is as an intermediary, as a secretariat, is, you know, companies and other donors and NGOs, they have a lot on their plate, right? They can't just focus on one partnership. They do, in many cases, appoint their own partnership leads. But to not have someone focused as their day job on the secretariat, on being the nexus of the partnership, ensuring that monitoring and evaluation is being done, ensuring that things keep moving, it's going to die out. And I can tell you that a lot of these partnerships take a long time to get going. They're extremely hard. And I wouldn't say this if it wasn't true, that a stage zero, we call it, which is the first stage of a partnership, it's when we're just, there's just a concept. You know, we want to figure out a way to provide medical supplies in a market, you know, get it out, get supplies out to the last mile. And who would we partner with? You know, and you could name off some names and, you know, I'm working on a partnership with stakeholders doing just that. But when you talk about how long does it take to get a partnership like that together, I'm talking years. The concept stage alone can take many, many months, just coming up with a 5 to 10 page concept note, believe it or not. Then you have the teaming agreement. Then you have the partnership agreements. Then eventually you need to figure out who's going to be funding this thing, what the sustainability is. You have to write volumes of proposals and functional documents and cost estimates. And then finally, you just get the right to be a partnership at the end of all that. Now you have to start selling where you're going to have this partnership go. Is it going to be multi-country? You know, what are going to be the complexities of doing that? You know, the world's constantly changing. So has the security situation changed in a country now making it non-viable? Things you don't think about. So if you're not willing to put the time in and the investment and have an intermediary, the partnership is truly just going to be a very small and siloed initiative. And then I think, you know, from the NGO lens, I think NGOs need to start talking more like business people. And I think they're doing that. You know, we recently participated in some training sessions at Interaction, and we've been working across the sector with our NGOs. By the way, we do work with the 30 largest NGOs on the planet through Accenture Development Partnerships. So we've been helping them think about what it means to be, you know, what it means to work with the corporate and private sector, and essentially what it means to talk business, essentially. And many of these guys have appointed their own partnership officers, their own corporate engagement leads. But, you know, when they're talking development, what does development mean? It means building markets, resilience in community, you know, thinking about what that means to a corporate, creation of jobs and talent that I need to run my organization. Vulnerable communities, you know, vulnerable populations, a corporation might see that as opportunity, you know, a new market for both skills and possibly a customer base. Capacity building, you know, to an NGO, you know, might be building a customer base to a corporate, you know, a sustainable customer base. And shared value, we already talked about profit that leads to impact. You know, essentially profit first, impact as an outcome of successful profit. And again, I just say that we, you know, have to sell locally as well, which is extremely important. So in conclusion, I know, you know, the sustainable development goals are on a lot of minds right now. And, you know, the key to the whole PPP is that they're going to be a key to successful SDGs being achieved. You know, it's not going to be like the Millennium Development Goals that were very siloed, very development oriented. These truly will be systems-based approaches that will require these partnerships. So now's the time, and that's why I think this next 8, 10, 15 years are going to be huge. And the last thing I'll say is that two huge trends that are coming into the sector right now are technology and digital. Accenture right now, 20% of its revenues are coming from digital. What do I mean by digital? I always think of a digital watch, right? Now, it's basically a combination of analytics and interactive and applied social media and mobility. And if you think about an Uber, right? Uber is an entirely technology-driven organization. You know, think of bricks and mortar. Think about an NGO of the future. Maybe it looks more like an Uber. You know, it's just kind of creates itself and everyone becomes part of that NGO. And I think that's going to be huge. And a lot of our clients right now are saying, how can I harness the power of analytics and big data, you know, to basically take my organization in a much more proactive way to address these development challenges? And then finally, the other huge trend, which I talked about earlier, is innovative finance. And we truly think this is going to be transformational to the sector. And impact investment, development impact bonds, these are the themes that we're being approached as Accenture right now to be part of. And I really truly feel over the next 24 months, you're going to hear a lot about that. So extremely excited about the future of PPPs and the fact that we are very early in the journey at this point. And if we do this right, you know, we're going to be looking back at some great success. So thank you, George, and forward to the panel.
We will get mic'd up and continue the conversation in about 1 minute. Thank you. Well, Roger, thank you very much. Not only did you set the context for our conversation, but I think you completed my research for me. So I think I will just capture your remarks. I'll go upstairs. I'll expand on it a little bit. And next week, it'll be done. Let me introduce our panelist. Angela Baker, in blue, is with Qualcomm. And she is the senior manager for Wireless Reach, which is a program that brings wireless technologies to underserved communities globally, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S., correct?
Correct.
Before she was at Qualcomm, she was at the Office of Innovation at the Department of State. And before that, she was involved in an international advocacy organization and worked and lived in countries around the world. Pascal, welcome. Pascal Wagner is country director for PCI in Guatemala, where she has lived and worked for over 15 years. And she manages a portfolio that ranges from health to water, food security, disaster risk mitigation, and community capacity building. Catherine Fritz is with the International Center for Research on Women, where she's director of global health and development. And she's particularly focused on understanding how gender compromises the health of individuals, communities, and families. And prior to ICRW, she was in the academic community. Thank you all for joining us today. I want to start the conversation with each of the panelists addressing two of the issues that Roger has put on the table, and that is, what is the interest, what is the incentive for your organization to participate in public-private partnerships? And what are the elements of success? I'm going to start with Roger, and you've already addressed those questions. And I want you to answer, you've explained to us what Accenture Development Partners is, but what was the incentive for this for-profit company to create this entity where it is pouring in its hard-earned cash, and it's actually a cost-loss center for Accenture? And so what was the original incentive 13, 15 years ago for that? And then in putting together a PPP, how do you start getting common agreement around a vision?
Yeah, so the first part of that question, really, why did Accenture create Accenture Development Partnerships? It's a pretty easy proposition if you think back 13 years ago, and that is
employee interest. And being able to leverage our skills, you know, which really is our people. You know, we don't have a product, we have people. We have 325,000 of them. And how can we get those people to leverage their skills in impactful ways around the globe? And one of the most important drivers to Accenture is being able to attract the best talent. So back then, that was a pretty novel concept. Maybe it would work, maybe we'd get a few people to come forward and be interested about, you know, working on a development project or having impact. And nearly 1,000 projects later, and that's only in 13 years, and essentially, you know, thousands of participants, we see that this is actually a huge differentiator for Accenture, for talent attraction. And essentially, when we get these MBAs that come forward today, why did you choose Accenture? Why didn't you choose one of our competitors? Well, it's Accenture Development Partnerships. I want to create something that I can do as part of my career that's integrated, where I can do something that's extremely impactful, where I can leverage my skills in different ways, or get exposed to new markets. But so that's probably the most important thing. What we also realize, besides all this attraction of getting the best talent, is also the brand and reputation of Accenture has been, you know, I'd say skyrocketed because of Accenture Development Partnerships. I mean, Google Accenture, you'll see Accenture Development Partnerships very often referenced across all of our industries and what we're doing. And increasingly now, it's become the crown jewel in the fact that our clients, you know, we didn't think about 13 years ago our corporates being at all involved in this sector. But what I said on the podium was that, you know, every corporate out there that is forward thinking out of the Fortune 100 and probably a good piece of the Fortune 500 is thinking about these PPPs, or at least thinking about how they get involved in development or new markets or have more impact. So we're in the perfect position now to differentiate our commercial programs by being able to leverage Accenture Development Partnerships. So don't just think of us as a for-profit, profit-making company that's going to maximize your business results. And most of our clients hire us for, just for that reason. But also think of us as a partner that can be with you as you take your corporation in different ways into new markets with social impact. We're there with you. And it's truly a differentiator because as a commercial business, we compete with many, many other firms out there. And to be able to put Accenture Development Partnerships in our proposals and in the case studies in the back of proposals is why we win bids today. To address your second question, I'd say, you know, how do you get one of these partnerships started? I think that can come in many different forms, and I could probably give you a half a day's worth of discussion around it. But I think it's understanding what the drivers are of some of the companies you're working with, and kind of there's a certain pulse, and it may not be a pulse that you know is immediately out there, but you kind of know what they're doing and what they're trying to achieve commercially. So I spend a lot of my time looking through the Wall Street Journal, and many, like I said, we already work with 90% of the Fortune 100, et cetera. But I look for what our clients, which are our commercial clients, are doing. And it gives me ideas to then approach them through our network and say, you know, you probably didn't know Accenture has Accenture Development Partnerships, let's talk. And then we start building those bridges and having those ideas and bringing together the right civil society participants or the right donors, and that's how it gets started in my world, typically.
Right, thank you. Those of you who are staying in the back, there are a few seats in the front if you would like to come join and take one of them. Angela, tell us a little bit about the wireless reach. And in doing that, answer the same question I posed to Roger. Why? Why is this for-profit company have a separate operation which is designed to bring its services, its capability, theoretically to people who can't pay for it, or can't pay for it at least in a way that the company can make a profit? And then talk about, you know, your experience and why Qualcomm and wireless are involved in these PPPs.
Absolutely. So I think that, you know, from Qualcomm, first of all, just let me, Qualcomm is the world's largest producer of mobile chipsets globally. So we're in your cell phones, your tablets, your e-readers. Since we're a B2B brand, some people don't necessarily know that. So I just want to make sure we're totally focused on wireless. We're totally focused on 3G, 4G, and, you know, upcoming 5G. From Qualcomm's perspective, we formalized what's called Wireless Reach, which is our corporate social responsibility arm, back in 2006, 2007 with the advent of CDMA technology. And we were looking, sort of for that shared value, for that competitive advantage. I mean, the CSR arm is directly aligned with business goals, and we're very upfront about that. We usually have a proposal process where we solicit proposals from organizations globally. And we say, you know, the focus of the corporate social responsibility arm is to sell more chips and is to accelerate the growth of mobile phone ownership globally. We also have a foundation and a corporate giving side, which is doing a lot of these social good things as well, but they don't directly benefit the company. So for starters, it's directly in line with business goals. And I would argue that we're not necessarily marketing to people who can't, quote unquote, afford our technology. Into that mobile space, of sort of skipping over the hardware, in their homes, and that everything's mobile. And a lot of people are getting information that way, they're getting services that way. So for a company like Qualcomm, I mean, it is directly in line with these strategic goals, and we are looking to go, you know, into emerging markets, you know, India, parts of China, sub-Saharan Africa, places that you would think where there are, you know, fewer people who are connected, but eventually it will not be an issue. In addition to that, you know, we work in five verticals, so we've got education, health, entrepreneurship, public safety, and the environment. And then cross-cutting across all of those are what we call M women or mobile women. And there's a long runway for growth here, right? Because there's 1.7 billion in the women in the world who are not currently connected from a mobile device. There's 62.5 million school children globally who don't necessarily have a mobile device. I mean, these are long runways for growth for a company like Qualcomm, for some of these what we, you know, might be considered adjacent markets, as opposed to the traditional just selling of chips to, you know, Sony or LG or companies like that. So that's sort of how we are looking at it. And this is the focus of the work that we do when we go into countries and we do these programs, we do these public-private partnerships to, one, you know, sort of show the need. There has been a lot of research out, especially for women, that says, you know, women in some parts of the world who don't have mobile phones maybe don't see the benefit of a mobile phone. So it's not that they can't afford it per se. It's that they don't know why they would want one. And so when you look at programs that are, you know, teaching women entrepreneurship skills, educating women, I mean, there's a lot of research around if you educate a woman, she educates her family. And so sort of sowing some of those resources. We're starting to move away from that a little bit because women are seeing the value of it, but it still exists in some parts. And so those are the types of programs that we're looking at. And when we go in, so where I sit in the company is within government affairs. So we're on the GA side of it. But we work very closely with our business development colleagues, of course, for the new technologies that are coming out, the new products. But it's important to work with governments and nonprofits in this space for a lot of reasons. One, there's a lot of regulatory issues that a company like Qualcomm faces when you're going into countries, also here at home in the U.S. Two, we need to open up more spectrum, not to get too technical, but so that there's more ways for people to use their phone and the connections are, you know, moving quickly. There might be some more technical people in the room that can address that, but of course those are issues that are regulated by the government, and so we need to, you know, work with governments and use advocacy platforms about, you know, what we're doing in country or how mobile phones are being used in country by their own citizens and why they need to open up more spectrum. In addition to that, you know, working with nonprofits usually, or sometimes universities or small, you know, social enterprises, because when you do go in a country, it has to be within a local context, right? So we can't go in India and do something in India that we did in Senegal because it's not going to work the same, right? Because you have to localize to the culture, to the to the content, to the language. And so I think that's why public-private partnerships are extremely important. So, you know, to date, we've been around since 2007. Qualcomm's been around for 30 years. It's our 30th anniversary this year. We have 105 programs in 40 different countries in various stages, but those are all unique to that country. So it's not like we're taking one program and just replicating it. And often we find that working with the government at the front end allows it to be much more impactful. And, you know, sort of what Roger was talking about, building that scalability and that sustainability. So just a quick example, we've been working in Morocco with mobile ultrasound devices. So working in rural areas outside of Rabat, giving women access to mobile ultrasounds, and then the images are transmitted over the 3G network on tablets and smartphones so that doctors in cities can review it. So if it's a clinician that's, let's say, taking the ultrasound but they don't know how to read it, doctors in cities can give an opinion, or doctors in other parts of the world can give a second opinion if it's a, you know, particularly hairy case, let's say. And then they can review it, they can make a recommendation based on that. But because at the beginning of that program, we worked with the regional health ministry, after 1 year of funding, the project has now become sustainable and the government is picking it up and funding it. I mean, that's like a best case scenario. It's very hard to do that, of course. And especially when you're working in these issue areas like education and health, which governments, of course, are extremely involved in, you have to bring them in from the get-go because you cannot do something in a country around health as a multinational company and have the government pick it up at the end of it, right? You have to sort of bring them in from the get-go. So it's kind of a lot of information, but
good. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Pascal, PCI, tell us a little bit about how public-private partnerships help PCI accomplish their objectives and their goals in Guatemala.
Thank you, George. You know, I'm going to be taking the field view. I'm going to be giving you a little bit of the our view in the field and how, as an organization, we're looking at these powerful public-private partnerships that might be available for us. You know, when you hear a lot about how there is such stress and pressure from urban, rural areas, people moving into urban areas, and how that is creating that big expansion, that big, these big mega cities that are being created now represent a problem for everybody, for the people that live there, the communities themselves, the municipalities, the countries, the governments, and also the private sector, and the security issues that that they also can represent in a country like Guatemala. And you know, when you're in the field, you're living it. You know, we're seeing that already. You know, we are seeing the impact of the migration on these cities. You know, to the point that some cities, some urban and rural now, there's a very gray line between urban and rural in certain areas because of these big settlements that are becoming cities, and the cities that are, you know, surrounded by big settlements that wish they would be more, that they would get more recognition and more a name for their cities or whatnot. So big issues that we're living already in the field. And that is what PCI has been trying to work with communities, finding great solutions to these great problems, and also involving these communities in the solution of their problems. So we see a huge opportunity. We're looking at how these people are working, how are they, what are their needs, what are their solutions, how do they see their well-being, how do they see their housing solutions being fixed, what are their visions for their communities. And so we've done quite a bit of research in that sense, and we work with women, we work with families, looking at what are the resources that they have available. A lot of the times, people that you meet in these urban areas are people that have migrated from rural areas, so from different rural areas, not from just one area. So there is a whole issue of lack of social fabric, social cohesion that also needs to be attended and understand how that works within the community and within the city. And we've done a lot of research in that sense. So all that community knowledge that we have, that a trust that we've created in these communities, the fact that we are very much aware of these issues, what they represent for them, and we work with the communities to find solutions to these issues, to these big issues, and what we can bring to the table when we're talking to private partners. So we work with communities, we work with private partners, we work with the municipalities and ministries and national governments, and trying to detangle all these issues and making something positive and something that can be solved. So in this sense, there is that big need. So it's very need-driven, the fact that we are reaching out to the private sector. We're currently in different countries in Latin America and Central America talking to big, to cement companies, for example, you know, which also this whole issue of working in these urban areas, you know, where you have needs for housing, where you have needs for wiring, you know, electricity within the houses and outside the houses, so networks and household installations, where you have huge issues, water and sanitation, sewage systems that are non-existent, security that needs to be improved, communication through cell phones, through phones or whatnot. So there is such an array of services that are still missing in these communities that we can help understand better. I don't know that the PVOs are supposed to be doing all the work. So that's when we really need to have to create these relationships to help these relationships with the private sector to be able to take these things to scale, take these solutions to scale and have them at the table working hand in hand with us to find greater solutions and more sustainable and the scalable solutions like Roger was mentioning.
Thank you. Catherine, ICRW.
Yes.
Give us a little bit on how ICRW sees the role of PPPs, and you just might want to say something about how PPPs can give women and girls more opportunities and advance women's empowerment and rights.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great question to ask. What motivates an organization like the International Center for Research on Women to partner with private sector companies? And we are a research organization, applied research organization. We do a range of research that helps to illuminate how gender inequality is a barrier to global development goals of many types, whether that be in health, economic development, social development. Mm-hmm. And we partner with a great many different types of organizations, mostly government organizations, as well as multilaterals like the UN. But about 10 years ago, we started to partner with some private companies and large corporations. And I think, and I want to just reiterate something that Roger said, which I think is really important, is that we don't get into these partnerships kind of haphazardly. We get into them because we want to understand how the partnership can help solve a problem. So the problem that concerns us is women's and girls' well-being and women's representation and equality and inclusion in economies. And it became very clear to us about 10 years ago that government aid and philanthropy alone was not going to be sufficient to solve this huge issue of women's inclusion in economies. And clearly the private sector was going to have to play a role. And that was very obvious because the private sector is the source of most formal employment, of course, and all the training and advancement that brings. They also can link women to markets, which is a huge and a critical aspect of women's economic empowerment. And companies and corporations can also create products that help enhance women's economic agency. So these are all things that are very interesting to us. And we started to partner mostly in the beginning with corporate foundations and CSR operations in order to see where our mission as an organization was in alignment with the business mission. And we found some of those. We found a great collaboration with GAP, and we have been a partner with GAP for nearly a decade, and we are their learning partner and help them formulate and then measure the impact of a program for garment workers in India that has now expanded outside of India to many countries in Southeast Asia as well as in the Middle East now. And that's been a great partnership. Increasingly, I think what we're interested in is also something that you mentioned, which is to start moving out of the CSR and the corporate foundation space and really understand how companies, as part of their core business mission, are opening up more opportunities for women's economic inclusion. So those are research questions that we really want to help answer. But because it's important to us as a women's rights advocacy organization, and we understand that it's also a business, can be part of a successful business model. And as much as, just one last thing, as much as I think organizations like mine perhaps are learning to speak in business terms, I think a lot of business leaders are starting to speak in our terms as well, as a nonprofit organization. You listen to many company CEOs now, for example, Paul Polson of Unilever, and you really get the sense that there's some really visionary thinking there. around how business can start to contribute to development goals. So I think the partnership aspect is really interesting to us, and kind of meeting in some kind of middle where we can really learn from each other and start to influence each other and have a discourse, I think, that is expansive for all of us and meets those goals that we have in common.
Thank you. Roger and Angela, let me ask you to talk about something that Catherine just mentioned, and that is the continuum from philanthropy to CSR to core values, shared value. And I started this research out expecting to be able to be very clear on the distinction of the three, and I range between clarity and less than being clear. You have added to my confusion today, Angela, I want you to know, because you've talked about your activity as being part of CSR, and it sounded like core business to me. So if both of you would give me a little bit about this continuum, and does it matter where an activity rests? Does it make a difference, particularly from the point of view of impact and sustainable results, as to whether or not something is from out of philanthropy or CSR or core value?
Sure, I'll take that one on. Basically, I think the actual continuum might possibly be applied to the same program. And from what I've seen, typically the core business, and there are different cases, of course, for every example, but in the cases I've seen, typically the foundation or the CSR initiatives are what kind of starts the stage zero, stage mm-hmm. one discussions. So the core business, in often cases, does not just go out there and say, I want to, solve, a micronutrition problem in a market. Whereas the philanthropy side of the house, the CSR, the applied CSR side, is where it usually starts. And they might come up with some seed funding to perhaps to do a market assessment or a study. Problem is often you face, is it a conflict of interest for a foundation of a company and also corporate, core business to get involved on the same program. But in many cases, we're talking about internally funded programs, not foundation funded in the case I'm describing. So what I found easier is to meet initially with people in the CSR space and have the discussion of what we're trying to solve in a kind of a social benefit way, but also talk a lot around what I think the business objective, the business opportunity will be, and ask for, how do we get this off the ground? And typically it's easy to get that discussion going with a little bit of funding from the CSR team. And that gets us down the road to start thinking about what the business model might be. We might even go into two or three countries and do an assessment of the market, perhaps put together some early stage business models and a framework for what a concept might be. Once we have that concept, it then might move into a core business capability if the model has enough potential to show a core business return. And I can tell you that, again, this is early days. So, we're not seeing a ton of these coming down the, pipe where we're seeing them turn from CSR initiatives to immediately to core business. So I can tell you it's going to take a lot of CSR investigation. That brings us to bring in the right partners and do the investigations, and maybe one out of 10, maybe one out of 20 might turn into an idea we can then move down that spectrum from, what we would call philanthropy to more tactical, strategic, and eventually transformative in nature. So that's what I've been seeing out there.
Okay, thanks. Angela?
I would say, I don't think it matters where the money is coming from, as long as it's done correctly. So there has to be sort of purposeful planning. There has to be, Qualcomm, we take monitoring and evaluation extremely seriously. We have a very robust M&E program for our wireless reach programs. But I think that, I'll give you two quick examples. So one, we've been working since, as I said, 2006 on mobile education and looking at how mobiles in the classroom and always on, always connected devices. Again, we're looking at, 3G, 4G side, not the 2G side, how that can impact and improve learning outcomes. So since we started doing that, we got a lot of great results from programs that we were doing. Kids' test scores were improving. They were becoming more engaged in their learning. We have now spun that off to a business unit. So we are continuing it on the CSR side for all of the reasons that I named earlier, but we've also spun it off into a business unit that's looking at how can this be a market opportunity for Qualcomm. So as Roger said, they don't always go that way, but sometimes they go that way. But in addition, you know, one of the things that Qualcomm's focusing on, like a number of other tech companies, because there's a huge problem, is STEM and increasing the diversity pipeline of STEM. So to get more women involved in, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math studies, minorities, traditionally underrepresented areas. Is that going to be a direct benefit to Qualcomm tomorrow? No. We're not going to see a direct benefit, although a more diverse workforce, all the studies show, does make, you know, business, does in allow you to do business better and be more profitable, and there's a lot of research out about that. But our philanthropy side and our corporate giving side is giving, you know, money to programs, Girls Who Code, Anita Borg Institute, NCWIT, a lot of these organizations that are doing, looking at ways to increase women's participation in STEM. In addition, the government affairs team and the wireless reach team is looking at how we can do actual programmatic evidence of, you know, getting more early engagement and continued engagement for girls and minorities has been proven to, you know, have them study STEM degrees and then get them into the pipeline. So that's going to benefit Qualcomm in the long run, but it's not going to benefit us tomorrow. But see, it doesn't matter if the, like, to me, it doesn't matter if the money's coming from the, the corporate giving side or the social, corporate social responsibility side or the BD side. In the end, if more girls and more minorities are studying STEM, then the work, then, you know, in 5-10 years, the ideas that we get coming out, 20 years, the ideas that we get coming out are going to be much more, you know, much more rich and much more diverse. So does that make sense? So I think that it doesn't necessarily matter, you know, which agency does. And again, if they're doing it right, or, you know, in my opinion, for Qualcomm, like, I work extremely closely with our business development colleagues. You know, like, any project I have, they're on the project calls, they're also meeting with the partner. So they're making sure it works from a business case, as well as corporate social responsibility case, as well as the PR case, which is a whole other reason why companies sort of make these types of investments. So I think it's really important to sort of have that coordinated effort.
Good. I've got a question for Pascal and Catherine, and then I'm going to open it up to the audience. Pascal, how do you find common ground when you're trying to put corporate together with business, with government, with civil society, and you maybe have multiple players? How do you find that common ground to start off a partnership?
I think for starters, we are working with the same people. You know, it's the, we are working with communities, and the private sector also wants to get a share of that market as well. You know, I see tremendous opportunities in that sense for the private sector in all of the things that we're doing. As I was saying before, no, all the infrastructure work that needs to go in the communities where we're working. You know, this is a great market for private sector.
Let me stop you there. So do you start at the community level and identify a problem or opportunity that is of interest to that community and then find the partners who might work on it?
We always start at community level. That's where our work is based on. It's community-based. It's based on the needs of the people and answering to these needs. So we always start at community level. And often when we get to see the magnitude of the problem, when we realize how big the problem is, you know, we can start doing some, we can do some pilot project. We can do a lot of research that comes with that as well. But then in order to take it to scale, it's way too much work for a PVO by itself to do, or for the government, for the weak governments in which often we work in these countries, to be able to tackle. So there is, we do need these type of partnerships to take things to scale and to the magnitude and to answer these big problems that they have. You know, it's too much for just one sector to be able to attend. So it usually comes from the ground. But, you know, as we design our programs, we already have usually partners in mind, you know, people that we want to bring to the table. And we feel that their inputs, their contribution will be very valuable for the program implementation and for the results that we are seeking. So there's a very big involvement from the ground, from people that we want, from the participants in the program, but always from the beginning also involving the sectors that we've identified, companies or other private sector players that we feel could have a essay at the in the issue and also in the resolution of that issue. You know, it goes. It's really a getting people, getting the different stakeholders at the table, and getting onto, you know, enriching our common grounds.
And Catherine, ICRW is a research institution, so my guess is you know something about evaluation. And it seems to me that evaluation would be a principal mechanism for us to identify the lessons learned and what works. And what are your thoughts on how we measure the impact, the success of PPPs, and how would we go about undertaking that evaluation?
Right. Well, you can always count on the researcher in the room to say that we need more research, so I will say that. But, you know, and I haven't been to business school, but I know the old business adage that you can't manage what you don't measure. And I think that businesses tend to be very good at measuring. But what we see, and we recently, ICRW recently conducted a scan of the top kind of leading largest corporate initiatives around women's economic empowerment. And what we actually see there is extremely little evaluation of programs. And so, it's a bit curious, but I think that one of the things that we're trying to do is, of course, encourage more evaluation of these programs. But what we also see, I think, is a lot of companies kind of rushing into the space of, for example, women's economic empowerment programming without having kind of refined their theory of change around what it is they're actually trying to impact. How would they know if they were successful? And setting up the monitoring systems that would allow them to see that progress and that impact. I don't know exactly what's de-incentivizing companies from setting up those rigorous systems and the way that they do collect data about their businesses, but it is definitely a gap that we see right now. One of the things that I would say that is very important for a monitoring system for these partnerships is that you have to measure both social impact and business impact. Because I specialize in measuring social impact doesn't mean that I would say that for these public-private partnerships to function smoothly and well and for everyone to be incentivized to continue to participate in them, businesses have to know what it's contributing to the sustainability and the prosperity of their business. And I think that the science is very in its infancy in really understanding how to measure the interplay between social impact and business impact. That's something that interests us a lot as researchers. We'd like to be more involved with that. But I think that there's no playbook available right now, I think, to say this is the M&E system you would set up to capture all of that. But as Roger said, I think as well, we're at the early stages of seeing how these PPPs work. But I worry that a lot of opportunities are passing us by to learn from them. A lot of really large multinational corporations are getting into this space. There are a lot of aspirations around increasing women's inclusion, for example, in value chains, but there's very little measurement of how those programs work and whether or not they're achieving true empowerment or if they are just reaching X number of women in X number of years. And that's what we tend to see more. We see more, we'll reach 20 million women by 2020, or we'll reach, you know, 10,000 women in the 10,000 Women Initiative, or something like that. So I think that it is something where we could do a lot better.
Well, I'm going to turn the program over to you. There is a microphone that will find you. Please raise your hand and introduce yourself and be concise because we have limited time. There's a hand right back at the back. And I'm going to take three questions so a couple other people can put up their hands.
Hi, thank you, panel, for sharing your thoughts. I'm Sid. I'm with the Calvert Funds. We're an impact investor based here in D.C. This question is directed at Angela and Roger. Would love your thoughts, too, on how impact investors can best engage with multinationals and these PPPs in order to accelerate the change we're looking for in the world. And would love you to be as specific as possible. Thanks.
Great. There's a question up here, Madeline, right up here. And thank you for setting a model for conciseness.
Hi, my name is Ann Johnson. I am a grad student at Georgetown, and I've had the opportunity to work with George on public-private partnership research. My question is, in the social impact space, we've had a lot of discussions lately about failure and the importance of talking about failure in order to learn from it. And so, building on what your comments were just now, for all of the panelists, what are some examples of projects that you've been engaged in, partnerships that you've done that have not gone so well, and what insights can you draw from those for all of the rest of us to learn from?
Good. And a hand right here in the middle.
Hi, thanks everyone. My name is Ida Gurma. I'm with Arabella Advisors. We're a consultancy that works with foundations, philanthropists, investors, corporations to increase their impact, social impact. So I was intrigued by the comments about having to sort of sell these PPPs to governments, and I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit more on the types of questions you get from governments when starting these conversations, pushback you get, and what you do to try to build trust.
Great, thanks very much. All right. Angela and Roger, I think you can start off by giving the gentleman in the back some inside tips as to how he can move impact investing. And then we'll move over to some examples of failure, if you have those, and dealing with government.
Starter.
Go ahead.
So impact investing or working with impact investors is not an area that we have delved into quite yet, but we would be open to it. And I think for just in my case, so at Qualcomm, we have a venture capital. There's a whole VC operation. And then there's also the CSR side. And I think both of those groups would be interested in learning sort of if, let's say, any impact investor or you had specific areas that you were looking to invest in, or if there were specific questions that you had. I mean, I think we'd be happy to sort of have those conversations. I'm not sure across the board how to engage with companies, although I do find that a lot of organizations and companies are doing a lot more public things around the type of investments they're making. I think, you know, to Catherine's point, I don't think we've achieved great yet, but we're getting a lot more questions about what is the impact of this? What are the impact of these dollars that you're spending, as opposed to just how many people are you reaching and just those kinds of numbers? And so I think that this is a space that we're going to see more in, hopefully. And so that it will become even more important. So I don't know that it's there yet, but I think it's going that way. I don't know if Roger, you have thoughts.
Yeah, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, impact investing is truly going to probably transform development, at least from a financing perspective, which is, of course, probably the most critical component. And we, you know, we are seeing the opportunities start to exist and arise for impact investing. The challenge is what is the impact investor's tolerance for risk, what the compliance regulations might be for the particular investment, you know, who, kind of what's the driver behind the specific impact investor? Are you looking for high rate of return? Is it more patient capital? So my point is that the opportunities exist and will continue to exist. In fact, what we're trying to do now is look at some new innovative financing approaches, particularly around how we can almost create portfolios of development projects in specific regions. I'll call it almost an investing hub per se, where an impact investor could get involved rather than at an individual project level, almost at a fund level. And then we could have the hub manage the monitoring and evaluation, manage the progress, and ultimately also disperse the risk across a number of programs. So I think you're right at the time where a lot of these concepts are coming to bear, and we would love to sit down and talk to you further and link you in with some of our clients and ideas.
The second question on failure, Roger, I'm sure that in the 1,000 projects that you all have done, there's been some failure somewhere around. And Angela and Pascal, do you all have any experience of going in a direction and beginning to do something in that direction? I don't know how far you took it, and then sort of backing off because you realized it wasn't going to work. And why don't we start with you, Pascal?
What I was going to say is that I cannot think of any failure really that we've had in that sense so far. But you know, as in any collaborative effort that one gets into, there are moments that you really need to stop and rethink your strategy or make adjustments. because you know, you're not working on your own, you're working with partners, and you need to reset or to re-talk things over. So yes, that happens, that you know, you need to take a break and take a deep breath and start making some adjustments to any. But that's the case with any collaborative efforts, and there are different types of collaborations that we.
So we do have examples of failure, absolutely. I'll tell you about one in Indonesia. So back in 2007, we partnered with the Grameen Foundation in Indonesia, and we're looking at a women's entrepreneurship program and giving women access to mobile phones. And we put a lot of money down front at the beginning, which we was not always the best idea, but and Grameen put a lot of money in and a lot of resources. And we did this whole landscape analysis about where the best place in Indonesia to start would be, because we wanted somewhere where the mobile penetration rate was there, but not too high, because we were trying, the point of it was to have, give women with what we called a phone in a box. So there was a phone, and they would buy the kit for their village, take it back to their village, and then they would let other people in the village use the phone, and then they would make profit off of it. So it was like the only, you know, phone in the village. And we thought this was great, and this was gonna work really well. So we did the analysis and figured out sort of where the sweet spot was, where we could go, where there was, you know, people were used to phones, but they weren't ubiquitous. And then we dumped all this money into it. And then by the time we actually got on the ground, the mobile penetration rate had outgrown us. Yeah. And everybody had phones. And it was like, this, nobody wants a phone in a box because I have my own phone. So why would I go to my neighbor to use this phone? And we had to, we were like, we have to go tell the executives that we just dumped, I don't know, like millions of dollars into this project, and it's not going to work. Right, which is not the meeting anybody wants to have. And so we had, you know, as Pascal was saying, like, you have to be flexible. So you can go in with one intention and you're going down this line, and then you have to take this big swerve. And so what we decided to do at that point was have the women, I mean, I'll be totally upfront, like, this is a story that has a really good ending for us, so it's a good way to tell a bad story. But, a good story. But the, you know, what we did is we had the women basically become top up minutes to their neighbors by their using their phone. So I have a phone, you know, it used to be you had to go to the, like, especially in, like, I lived in Palestine for a while, or the Palestinian territories, and you had to go and actually buy more minutes for your phone. So the women were able to do that from their phone, so people didn't have to walk into town. And it allowed them to become profitable. It allowed them to get the phone they got from the box and actually use it to make money. Now, we've had a couple of iterations from this program, and what happened next was there was, you know, a job board was invented, and the women who had, I mean, there are men and women, but it's predominantly women that have the phones were able to tell their neighbors about jobs that were available in their town and neighboring towns, and they could market that. It's become so successful now. There's 15,000 entrepreneurs in it. About 85 to 90% of them are female, and 100% of them are profitable. And they've gone, people that stay in the program for more than 4 months have moved above the poverty line, which the World Bank decided, you know, $2.50 a day. But it became so profitable that it actually spun off into its own social enterprise. So now companies like Danone and Nestle are doing market research, right? Because there's 15,000 women who have access to a mobile device. So it's really easy for a company like Danone to go in and say, I'm going to do market research. I'm going to push out this survey. So Qualcomm's no longer involved in that. We're not funding that anymore. But that was a case of, I told you there was a good ending, but that was a case where it started out and we, you know, we thought we were going to go in great guns and then do the research. Which is never a good idea, right? Do the research on the front end. I'm sure Catherine would agree with that. But also, like, you have to be able to change course. So you can't be so hard and fast steadfast in what your direction you were going to take is that you can't move if it's necessary.
So the lessons there are do research.
Yes.
Don't put too much money in up front and be flexible.
Be flexible, I think, is key, yes. But definitely be flexible.
Roger? No failures in those 1,000 projects.
100% success rate. No, essentially, I could give you, I'll call them lessons learned.
Opportunity.
Yeah. Nothing is ever, you always learn from it, right? So I'd say a good example from a partnership is one that's actually been quite successful, and it's called Project Laser Beam. It's one that we were the secretariat for. Between three large food companies, the UN, and Global for Gain. And essentially, we have served as a secretariat, as I mentioned, and the whole idea was to address childhood malnutrition. And one of the things that I think was the biggest lesson learned from this is that although those food companies and everyone wants to solve that problem, the market forces versus the NGO forces and interests are at two sides of the spectrum. So if you go after the most vulnerable, most impoverished, most needy populations, there's no market. And therefore, how can you create a sustainable partnership? So kind of understanding what market you're actually targeting to make sure you can achieve the objectives of both the NGO, civil society side of the house, and the side of the market itself. And then secondly, I'd say another learning from that one was the population. The NGOs wanted to go after two years and younger, and the corporate partners are like, we don't market to that audience. We want to go after, you know, the parents, the older population. So that led to, you know, some friction within the partnership. You know, I could give you other examples of, you know, ideas that, you know, we were going to solve secondary education in Tanzania.
Frictions in that partnership, if they had been addressed early on when the partnership was being developed, would it have resolved it, or would it have led everybody in a different direction? You wouldn't have had a partnership.
It's probably one we could, in hindsight, right, have worked out up front and focused on the right demographics in the right locations. And this was a five-year program, so we had the opportunity to course correct over the 5 years. Mm-hmm. But it's also one that it's a sine wave over that period. So there were the ups and downs. And again, if you could stay the path, it led to success. And I was just going to throw out one more. You know, it's just a partnership that we were involved in around secondary education in Tanzania, teacher shortage. You know, the biggest problem there was an ownership amongst more than one partnership. We had the government very much on board. They wanted the outcome. They were actually sold on helping them solve this problem, but not enough corporate or donor funding behind the program to make it successful. So they had 5,000 schoolhouses and, you know, one teacher when they needed four per schoolhouse. And the funding to do that would have been tremendous. Could never raise up the donor and corporate support to do it. So ultimately, the project didn't achieve its objectives. So kind of understanding how each of the partners have a stake in the game and what they're going to be funding and what they're going to be doing is very, very important. So that's a learning from that.
Please.
One thing about failure, and I'm really glad you brought this up, because it's also a unique challenge, I think, for the private sector, because money that's been invested in a program, you may fail and learn lessons from it. I think one of the higher level questions is how do those failures and lessons get be made visible so that others in the sector or the industry can learn from them? And that's one place where I think the development sector has, we have platforms for sharing what works and what doesn't. We have ways of convening groups to talk about it and to strategize. And I think for the private sector, because of issues around being either proprietary concerns or just wanting to put your best foot forward to the public about what you're doing, that they're just organically, there aren't enough opportunities to share those kind of failures or lessons learned and build, as you go from them.
And the question of government and pushback, who wants to address that?
I'll take a shot. because we work with very often with basic needs and basic services that are not available, we also, as PVOs, we are very careful and very respectful of government guidelines, of government policies. So for us, it makes it a lot easier at times to sell programs or ideas to the government, because we already have from the beginning, when we are going into a country or into a community with a health program or an education program or whatnot, we look at what the government, what are the plans of the government, what are they tackling this issue, how are they tackling this issue. So, from the beginning, our program designs usually already take into account the priorities of that government and what we bring to them are solutions very often. So maybe from our standpoint, it's easier for us to sell the ideas to the government because we are already taking into account what their government plans and national plans are already. So that for us, it might be a little, we have a different angle and might be more successful at it?
I think from a company perspective, it's hard for U.S. companies to go into foreign governments and say, we can help you fix your education system, right? That's a, you'll get a lot of pushback for obvious reasons. And so, you know, for us, when we're working in countries, I mean, I think that's why it's so important to engage the government from the get-go, because definitely, as I said, it doesn't work to start doing something and say, hey, we want to bring you in on this. We're doing this great. We're totally revolutionizing the way fifth grade is taught in China. Like, the Chinese government is not going to react well to that. You know what I mean? So I think that that is some of the pushback when Roger was saying, like, you have to sell it. Like, you have to engage them from the get-go, because otherwise, and these are, you know, just as the U.S. government would act that way, right? I mean, the U.S. government would act the same exact way. And of course, they're promoting, you know, local organizations, local companies, all those types of things. So,
yeah, so just, you know, that's exactly a great point, is the local, you know, local engagement is key in selling the government and leading to jobs and kind of getting those jobs engaged into the partnership early. I think that truly is a key differentiator for getting the buy-in of the government. You know, a lot of donor funding isn't unlocked until the government actually says go or selects the partnership, right? So our donors have to, in many cases, fund the government, which in turn just turns around and selects the partnership. So if they don't say go, then we can't go. And that's the key. And also, we've had, this is a challenge also, is it's taken so long to unlock that decision in many cases, the administration of the government has actually changed. So we were right there with the Ministry of Health in, you know, in Mozambique, and there was an election. And, you know, then the game changed. So we had to start again from day one. So it's really getting as quickly as possible the engagement of government, showing the benefits, you know, convincing the right stakeholders, and then getting someone to make a decision. It's all really, really key. But, you know, again, you'd be surprised at how many governments are cautious before, you know, they just say go, especially in places that have been over. I think, you know, there's been too many PPPs, too many concepts being tried out. They almost feel like they're a testing ground for new business models, and they're getting fatigued. So, you know, you need to realize that there might have already been five other tries that failed. They're like, you're the sixth person here. You know, why is yours going to be different? And we see that in certain countries. So, in many cases, choosing the right countries that haven't been so over-tested with different concepts also is a key.
I'm going to comment on this last conversation, but before, I want to give the panelists a warning. We're at the witching hour, so I'm going to ask you all to each leave us with a parting comment. And my comment on this is, the interesting thing about this conversation about working with government and pushback from government, and earlier you gave an example which sounded to me like the government didn't trust the private sector. And if you look at the new set of sustainable development goals compared to the MDGs, they are very much centered on the role of the private sector and what it can bring for sustainable development. And it sounds like this is a case where maybe those sustainable goals, that aspect of the sustainable goals, are ahead of where reality is with a lot of governments around the world. But Catherine, I'm going to start with you, and you can say anything except that we need more research.
Yeah, okay. I'll say something that implies that we need more research. No, I think this is just a really fascinating and exciting time. I think we all have embarked on a really big experiment, which is to see how the private sector can contribute to sustainable development. And it's a very creative time. It's encouraging to see these partnerships come together. And I think that my parting word would be just that we really examine the word partnership to really understand what motivates each member of that partner to come together and how we can kind of align goals and really understand and see each other's perspectives and gain from each other's expertise, and rather than it really has to be shared. I guess that's the end message, is that the goals have to be shared, the tactics have to be agreed upon, and I think that is, as you said, a process. It takes a long time to build. But hopefully we'll have some evidence 10 years from now when we gather again. We will be able to look backward and see how this whole experiment played out, hopefully to the advantage of global development.
Pasquale?
Thank you.
I want to say that at PCI, we're really good partners, and it's in our DNA to do partnerships. We really believe in partnerships, and we've been good at the working with partners that we've had so far. More recently, PCI has joined the Clinton Global Initiative, and we have two specific initiatives that we're moving forward through our partners at CGI, and they are the urban upgrading and the women empowerment initiatives. And I hope that soon we'll have lots of success stories and few failures to share with you. Thank you.
We didn't have any failures, just so keep up. I would just sort of reiterate, like, I think exactly what Catherine was saying, this sort of purposeful planning when you're going into a partnership, whether it's public-private or private-private, but, you know, bringing in partners that complement each other. You know, Qualcomm, we're a tech company, so if we're doing an education project, we definitely have to have a content provider, right? Because we're not going to come up with content and create content. So bringing in partners that complement each other, I think will ensure, you know, sustainability and scalability for the program, which is sort of what private sector is looking at when they're funding these types of programs.
And finally, just building on that, I truly feel, you know, we're at the cusp of this true convergence of, you know, of issues and outcomes between these sectors. And we're seeing it every day. You know, we're seeing it within civil society, we're seeing it within corporates. And I just feel that this next probably even 2 to 3 years is going to be critical and also very impactful on where these things are going to go. So I would say this is almost a real-time issue that if we look back, you know, even a year from now, there's going to be a lot of learnings and a lot of great new ideas that are going to drive, you know, how these PPPs function and scale and deliver on their results. So I'm really, really excited.
George, let me again thank you and Richard for bringing the idea of this panel to me in this session. And I thank the panelists. I thought it was a very productive conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, George.